This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 14th of May, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on the show, we decamp to New York for the Pratt Institute's annual degree show.
It's really the hallmark of a four-year education at Pratt. The collection, they work on it all year long.
Elsewhere in the Big Apple, we attend the latest design fair on the block, Collective One.
For me, this has always been about inclusivity, not exclusivity. There are works here that are inexpensive that someone can come in and buy. You don't have to be a patron, you don't have to be a collector to enjoy this fair.
And back in London, we sit down with Dutch design legend Lee Edelcourt.
I believe that for the luxury industry, the fetishization of their world is imminent and very important, actually. So they should give more meaning to whatever objects they produce.
Plus, we survey the state of Made in Italy in design with two Italian manufacturers, Cassina and Moroso. We'll hear from director of the Helsinki Design Lab, Marco Steinberg. And we'll drop in on Hong Kong leather studio, Fungus Workshop, too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's show in New York at an institution shaping the next generation of America's skilled designers. Founded in 1887, Brooklyn's Pratt Institute is home to America's oldest fashion design program. It recently hosted its 114th annual fashion presentation. Showcasing more than a dozen senior thesis collections, this year's runway show offered a glimpse of bold designs and rigorously engineered conceptual pieces. The Institute also presented American designer Tom Brown with its annual Fashion Visionary Award. We sent Monocle's Barrett Austin along for a chat with Mr. Brown, as well as Pratt's head of fashion design. Barrett also canvassed the opinions of a student who caught his eye too.
New York's Pratt Institute is home to America's oldest academic program teaching students the art of fashion design. For more than a century, graduating design students have been selected to participate in the school's annual fashion show. With a pervasive energy not unlike the catwalk shows of New York's own Fashion Week, Pratt's student presentations showcase the school's top talents, a number of collections that evolve over the fourth and final year for a handful of talented design students. Jennifer Minetti is the head of Pratt's fashion design program. After the final hoots and hollers of the recent show, we met atop the catwalk for a brief chat. I started by asking about all the effort that goes into making the collections a reality.
It's tremendous. I don't know what's more difficult. They work on this. It's really the hallmark of a four-year education at Pratt. And this thesis, the collection, they work on it all year long. I'm sometimes amazed every year that it happens, and it happens brilliantly, and with impeccable craft, and that the students are really responsible for the head-to-toe look. So it's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Like many university-level presentations, Pratt's fashion show hands students a considerable degree of challenge. But it also offers soon-to-be fashion graduates an opportunity to showcase a full runway collection to a host of influential designers, journalists, and possibly even buyers who fill several hundred chairs in the Chelsea warehouse where the show is presented. Minetti's opinion suggests that the fashion show is very much a lasting hallmark for her students.
They may never get this chance again. Before the show, they participate in a jury over at Canoe Studios, and they show their collection to a panel of experts in the industry. And that in itself is a great experience. And then to come here and to show some of the most important people their collections is a real privilege, and they deserve it.
Among the most conceptual designs offered at this year's presentation, the work of student Sam O'Brien offered an unusual, albeit beautifully turned out collection that's the culmination of more than 12 months of hard work. I ask O'Brien about his inspiration.
My collection was inspired by my time in Iceland. I lived there over the summer, interning with a designer, and just the textures that surrounded me, I just developed into a lot of fabric manipulations, and just the silhouette kind of organically came up, like introduced itself to me.
While many of O'Brien's works appeared somewhat approachable, several designs were purely conceptual explorations of fabrication and silhouette. Here's O'Brien again on his process.
My most conceptual pieces, I developed just a technique of taking silk file and saturating it with wax and scraping away the excess, which turned into very stiff fabric, but when like creased, it made itself to look like ice. So of course that's a very literal interpretation of what I saw of myself in Iceland. I also experimented with rubbers and resins just to, with the secondhand concept of developing these textures that represent the natural environment but with very synthetic material.
And while the spotlight firmly shone on the students who were soon to graduate, Pratt Institute also took time to honor American designer Tom Brown with its Fashion Visionary Award. Over the past decade, Brown has amassed a cult following across the world, best known for his neatly tailored, mid-century inspired aesthetic. I spoke with Brown about the award just before he took to the stage to receive his honors.
Any type of award amongst your peers, and especially from an institution that really is so important in the world of design, is special.
And while it's altogether fitting that Mr. Brown received Pratt's award, some in attendance were quick to note that the designer himself had never studied fashion in school, but rather learned the skills on the job. I ask how he responds to young designers who cite his example as a reason not to study fashion at university.
Well, they're right. I mean, they can. I think anybody can do whatever they want. But be serious about it and definitely do it because you really want to actually design and make clothes. Don't do it for the fame or for the money, because most likely that's not going to happen.
For Monocle, in New York, I'm Barrett Austin.
You're listening to Section D. We're heading to Italy next to talk business and design with Cassina and Moroso.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now the dust has settled after the Salone del Mobile in Milan. The focus of discussion, particularly for the Italian brands, is less on furniture and more on their business future. Cassina is one of Italy's older furniture firms, which prides itself on its archive of classic design pieces as much as its more recent releases. Monocle's Alicia Kirby sat down with Cassina's brand director, Gianluca Armento. They discussed how the brand is currently trying to innovate by integrating technology into its furniture, with everything from floating plates to 360-degree mirrors. Armento also told Alicia how he's trying to move Cassina into the future and widen the company's appeal into China and beyond.
Cassina has always been an innovative company. The fact is that most of its most brilliant innovation was done in the 60s and 70s now makes Cassina look a little dusty. Hence, looking for new designers, we're also looking for new innovation and the right accident to happen at the right time. So another project which you must go and see isn't here in Raw, but it's in the Cassina showroom and hopefully soon in the showroom in London, is called Our Universe, and it's worked with an MIT professor called Carlo Ratti, who's exploring the latest technology applied to furniture and the lounge. And you will see how he's working on 360-degree mirrors, sensing and responding cabinets, floating plates on tables, and seven wonderful projects that will stimulate the public to think about what could happen to their homes in a couple of years' time.
And is this kind of move into integrating technology into furniture what you've done with the Philippe Starck sofa as well that you're launching today?
Exactly. It's one and the same thing, in the sense that Cassina is always an intellectual company. So it's always asked itself, where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms? And in that case, with Philippe Starck, we looked at how do we make a sofa that allows people to live in it, because people are staying more and more at home, even professionally, and that has to be the center of their world, of their universe. Hence the term My World for the sofa, which is a sofa that allows you to be energetically independent and connected to anybody by sitting down. Hence you can basically charge your computer, you have a wireless system for your smartphones, and you can store your documents in the cabinets, which are part of the sofa.
Yeah, because it's quite interesting. I've never seen, you have like a little pad, which is a wireless computer charger, so you don't need to actually plug it in.
Well, we have a collaboration with the Duracell PowerMat. There's a battle going on currently worldwide on the protocol for wireless. All the cell phones in the future can be charged with a wire, but they will all be wirelessly chargeable by just positioning the phone on a receptacle. Today, one needs a sleeve on the phone as an interchange, but in the future, there will be a direct application of the smartphone onto the receptacle. We're introducing wireless charging in our cabinet.
How important is, you know, that Made in Italy brand still to Casino, and is everything is manufactured in Italy?
It's extremely important if it's done in two ways. If it's done using technological innovation, and if it's done using a much more difficult, or let's say an as difficult aspect, which is the innovation of form and senses, okay? Because there is a so-called Italian look, the Italian way of life, the Italian balance in form, shape, and color. That is something very sophisticated to do, which isn't easy, declinable elsewhere. But it needs to be innovated on. How does the Italian manufacturer of furniture bring out these new forms and shapes and guide the world into what is going to be proper furniture tomorrow?
And do you think that kind of Made in Italy aspect kind of pushes up the prices of, you know, Casino products as well, because of that kind of striving for that quality?
Well, what pushes prices up is not the technology, is the time, the cost per hour per person. If that person, which of course the cost per hour per person in Italy is much higher than in Asia or South America, okay, that's banal, but how does our craftsman put in that savoir-faire in a new manner is the real challenge. So exactly the second point I was saying. So the more people costs you have in making a piece of furniture, the more they have to do something which one cannot imitate.
And do you think that's something that makes Casino so unique, that you have a lot of people costs as opposed to manufacturing costs that other places have?
Well, we have a lot of technology investments this year in our molds, in our aluminium parts. But we also have 250 people working for us as employees, and we have to make sure that they are doing something which is every day more special, which one cannot imitate. So that is a constant challenge I have in bringing to the world something which will be ahead of its time, so that we're able to survive better in this context.
Casino's making kind of big moves into Asia. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, big moves into Asia mean that we are building on our platforms, in the sense that we have a very relevant Japanese business. We have strong hubs in South Korea, Singapore, while the greater Chinese market is a playing ground where we need to accelerate on. So we do have openings coming up shortly in Shanghai and Beijing, which will reinforce our Asian position.
And you find in kind of new markets, and Singapore seems to be kind of rising in terms of its design kudos. Is that a new market at all, or any other ones?
It's been an established market for Casino for a while, because it has an international culture, and Casino needs an international population to appreciate it. That makes it more difficult, on the other hand, for us to grow in China. So part of our strategies are also working with names like Philip Stark and Lagerfeld, is linked to Casino needing to become globally comprehensible, also at another level, at a stylistic, emotional level, as well as an intellectual level.
And some people might have been surprised with your collaboration with Karl Lagerfeld earlier this year.
Well, that was, talking about accidents, that was a natural, it was almost a family affair, in the sense that Karl Lagerfeld is a frequent customer of our store in Paris, and he has a fantastic relationship with our store manager there. And then when they were talking about the wonders of Casino, the theme came up of what could happen more between Karl Lagerfeld and Casino itself. And he was very keen to know if we had any idea that he could be stimulated on. And hence the set of photographs came up. And we are thrilled with what he's done, because he was able, as we thought he would be, to interpret the silhouette, the black and white, the icy personality of some of our icons in a wonderful way.
Gianluca Armento, brand director of Cascina, there with our Alicia Kirby. Now, staying in Italy and the furniture sector here on Section D, we're training our sights on another of the country's best-known design brands. Moroso is associated with eclectic pieces, whether it's a sprawling sofa or a simple stool. Much of the credit is due to Patrizia Moroso, who in the mid-1980s joined the family business and transformed the firm into a leading name in the design world. Moroso's approach is not market-driven. She explained to Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho that while exports are key to her company's future, she's in no hurry to chase emerging markets and customers that aren't in line with the brand's philosophy.
Now, you're a family-run design brand. Is there an advantage in that, in this kind of a sector?
It's a fantastic Italian typology. And this, for me, a sort of secret of the Italian design, how and why it was so special, peculiar, since the beginning. Italian design is a story about relationships, friendships between companies or people, owners of the companies, and designers, architects, and people that are creative minds. You can risk by yourself because you are the company and not a manager. And that is very important when you have to decide things and be brave, so to go where you want.
Looking at the many design brands in Italy, with Moroso, it's always hard to pigeonhole where the brand is. I'm just curious, you like to be very hybrid, let's say.
Yes, hybrids is fantastic. Melting pot is another word that I love. I love, you know, like I was saying before, I love to mix things, to mix thinking and to mix people. I like to think in a multicultural way and do things that can be a mixture of inspirations. I like to have, I don't know, yesterday I saw a girl, beautiful, she was dressing a kimono done with an African fabric, and I find this so fantastic and so good respect what is our world now.
Interesting you mentioned fabrics, because I noticed you're very good with working with fabrics.
Yes. One of our most important items is working on surfaces of our objects. So the surface of an upholstery piece is a fabric, leather, everything. And we, in every single project, when we decide with the designer, of course, the shape and the details of the shape, but never the shape is separated from the skin, like a person, an object done by us, as always a surface that is absolutely that thing that it needs to have. So this is the reason why we are working a lot on the new fabrics, making something that is related with the project. For instance, we have now a project done by Mark Thorpe, an American young designer, and he was working on the shape of a sofa, very simple, clean, very geometric, but he was especially working on the fabric done to cover this shape. That is a beautiful jacquard with a blaring of one color, so going from the very intense tone to disappear in white. And this thing makes the sofa special, because the sofa, if it's not that thing, is a normal geometry shape.
People have been talking about exports to help Italy out of its recession. Do you see new markets that are interested in this kind of furniture coming to you now?
Yes, export is for us. We are Italian, but our company is very internationally oriented. We are making more than 70% of our turnover out of Italy. In South America, Brazil, for instance, is a perfect country to be understood also. Brazil has a long tradition and a long heritage of design and architecture. So it's easy for them to understand what we are doing, we Italians, I mean, and companies like us. It's different, for instance, talking about China, that for the moment I think is a big, huge market, but they have to learn a little bit more about design, what it is and why and so on. They know everything about fashion in China and nothing about design. So for the moment for us it's not a big market. We are waiting for the new young architects that I'm sure they are coming, and they are in effect starting to be here. And probably in some years, I say 5 maybe 10, I don't know, it could be a big possible market.
That was Patrizia Moroso, CEO of her eponymous furniture brand there, with our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho. You're listening to Section D. Up next, we're off to Hong Kong to talk leather. Now it's time for our weekly nose around the studios and workshops of the designers who've caught our eye, where we let them tell the story of their day-to-day work practices, their inspiration, and also play a little bit of the music that they listen to. Tucked away on a quiet street in Hong Kong's Shung Wan neighbourhood is Fungus Workshop, set up in 2009 by two couples, Hoi Mung Fung and Baldwin Pui, and Philip Lau and Grace Kwok. Fungus not only produces its own range of custom homemade pieces, but also serves as a leatherworking classroom, with studio sessions held almost daily. Monocle visited the busy workshop and met with Baldwin Pui.
Now we are sitting on in front of my workshop. It's in Shuanghuan and Po Heng Fong, number 4. And this is a quite interesting space because the area here is quite silent, and the atmosphere and the lifestyle here we love so much. That's why we decided to locate in Po Heng Fong. This workshop we are run by two couples actually. Me and my wife, and Philip and his wife as well. So four of us, we make all the leather things here, not only handbags, maybe some small accessories or something we will use daily, or something we certainly we need something to carry, so we will make the bag, something like that. So it starts from we run the place to work some project by ourselves, but later we continue and meet more people. Join and ask if we can share my technique to them. That's why we run this workshop. If you want to handmade on leather, there are quite a lot of tools to help, and they're quite useful because we just, as I told you before, you cannot just use needle and thread. So each of the steps, we have some special tools. Let's say for the cutting, for the start, we need to cut out the leather. Traditionally, the craftsman will use some leather knife, but it's quite dangerous, and you need to practice more with before you learn how to handle it. So we will suggest them to use the cutter. It's easier and more safe. And then, before you make the holes, we need to draw a line, like a guideline, before we hammer. So we need stitching. We draw the line with the edge greaser, and then we use the stitching chisels to make the holes, and they have different kind of number of the holes, like 1 hole, 2 hole, 3 holes, 4 holes. So we design which kind of holes we want, and then we use the stitching chisels to hammer the holes, and then we can use needle and the leather thread. The thread we will use some nylon thread with west. In front of our door, we have like a outdoor area. We have some natural wind blows and sunlight, and we're under that area. And this is our second shop. The first shop, we locate before, it also have this, almost the same area, because we like growing some plants as well. We like some green color and like some smelling some flowers. So we enjoy this kind of area. Philip and I, we love jazz a lot, and because it will let us feel relaxed and concentrate on our work. So we like to playing with some jazz music, like a background music that people or join the workshop, they also listen to that kind of music and they can relax and focus on their work. I think we played quite often in this workshop is the Ben Webster.
And that was Ben Webster with Soulville there. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Still to come, we'll be attending New York's newest design fair and asking if design really can improve the way businesses and governments run. But first, let's talk fetishism. This month, one of Europe's top fashion spotters and trend soothsayers, Lee Edelcourt, is busy promoting a huge exhibition to open later this year called Fetishism in Fashion at the Mode Biennale in Arnhem in the Netherlands. Despite its niche, marginalised and often still shocking status, fetishism is seen as a tradition that has inspired wardrobes and catwalks far beyond the sleazier side of life. In a peaceful and suitably luxuriant London hotel room, Monocle's David Pleasant met Edelcourt and talked leather, textiles and cushions.
I decided to pick the idea of fetishism in fashion and try to understand what it is all about, where it is going. It has been influencing fashion since the 70s, actually, but it became really strong in the 80s with Montana, Mugler and so on, where it was lots of leather. It was the period of the emancipation of the gay movement. So at that point, clothes became very assertive and with lots of bondage and lots of mean detailing. And you see this again now, coming back this week. It was the punk show in New York. And although nobody really still knows what is punk, you could see that there were still these influences going strong. But there is a more general idea on fetishism, where it is the bonds we have with our objects. All the people with the good luck bracelets, you know, the thousands of good luck bracelets in the world. The lockers in Paris on the bridge, where you just, you know, declare your love and then it's formalized by a fetish. The idea of fetishism also in a more anthropological context. So the more shamanistic and animistic objects and outfits and textiles and feathers and ropes and grasses and almost a more ecological aspect of the fetishism. So it's a very, very, very vast domain. And the more I've been studying, the more I came to this very amazing discoveries about what it's really going to give us.
You mentioned kind of that your work researching textiles, and a couple of years ago you spoke at length and curated a show on textiles at the Salone. Tell us a little bit about that and how that has progressed and your feelings on the world of textiles and how it can kind of transgress that kind of industrial notion to something more adaptive. Is that still something that interests you?
Yeah, we continue to do work on talking textiles because it's still very necessary. You know that we might live without textile if we don't save it soon. And trends do indicate that we really want to surround ourselves with more textile-driven design. So there's more carpets, there's more rugs, there's more mats, there's poofs, cushions, even curtains coming back in new ways. So there is an upholstery, of course, of furniture, which was almost gone and suddenly is making a remarkable comeback, with even sometimes clothes for your furniture. So it's like separate pieces you can pull over your chairs. So I'm very happy to see that there is more and more of it. And I believe that it is really related to this idea to want to be more nomadic, live more close to the floor, live more at ease, have less furniture in a way, and more small items which you can carry around. So I can only see that textile will grow. It's an expression of our need together, forces to be together, to share, to somehow mend, I would say, the textile of society.
So as you were just talking about some of the explorations that you've had in terms of looking at fetishism and where it came from, where it's going and so on, where do you think it can tie in to some, you know, real life trends, some real life sectors, for instance, the luxury sector? How could that have an influence?
Well, we see today that luxury brands are really focusing on objects and accessories, and in a way they produce fetishes all the time. Maybe they don't know, but when a thing becomes a bestseller, I believe that it has a fetishistic quality, because people can somehow put their dreams, their ideas, their erotism, their spirituality, whatever they want to put into this high heel, this sneaker, this fountain pen, or this beautiful necktie. All these objects are a sort of, you can say, a prothèse. It's like a prolonging piece of yourself. And in this piece, whether it's a skull or a corset or a shell, whatever you collect, you know, whatever fascinates you, is a way to exteriorize all sorts of emotions. So it can be erotic, but it can be also spiritual, or it can be just about well-being. So I believe that for the luxury industry, the fetishization of their world is imminent and very important, actually. So they should give more meaning to whatever objects they produce. They really have to be animated, like anima. So it becomes a very different way of looking at that market.
You're already giving us some insights and some tips about what you think the future will hold, but it would be good to know a little bit more about what's involved in the world or the daily life of a trend or fashion forecaster. It's quite a mysterious concept for somebody who maybe doesn't know. And are there any methods that, do you have a kind of set way of going about predicting future trends, or is it something that's more emotional and that just kind of comes to you?
It's actually a combination of rational thinking and emotional and intuitive feeling. So I have learned to make my intuition work almost on its own. It's always observing whatever happens. And I somehow seem to be able to analyze and sort of archive little fragments of ideas and givens in society already. And when you have critical mass of all these fragments at one point, it knocks on your brain and says, you know, I've got news. There is this word, or there is this idea, or this color, or this notion, or this sphere, this aura, whatever comes up, that announces itself to me, in a way. So I'm, in a way, a sort of transmitter, you can say. So I'm catching it. I'm like radio.
Lee Edelcourt talking to our David Pleasant there. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. After this brief interlude, we'll be back in New York to attend Collective One, the city's newest design fair.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
House Vision in Tokyo is an exhibition that combines the wisdom of Japan's best creative thinkers with state-of-the-art technology. Curated by the visionary designer Kenyahara, the mission was to explore new and unconventional ways of urban living.
Japan's post-war growth spurt might have brought wealth, but one of the great ironies is that despite rising incomes, most Japanese live in homes that are cramped and uniformly bland. For all the expert craftsmanship that goes into building homes here, rarely do they last more than a generation.
House Vision, a future perfect film from Tokyo, on Monocle.com.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Whilst much of the buzz may have been about Frieze Art Fair descending on the city, a new design fair took place in New York last week too. Collective One hopes to fill a gap between the sprawling but glamorous ICFF design fair and the more fusty antiques-focused events that do little to capture the public imagination. Stephen Lerner, the founder of Collective One, gave Monocle's Pauline Eiferman a tour of the space on the eve of its opening.
We're inside Pier 57, looking out at the Hudson River through a large window. Unlike many piers in Manhattan, which take in cruise liners like the Queen Mary, This one has been in disuse for a while. It's a space of 70,000 square feet, which boasts the logo of the Department of Marine and Aviation on its imposing but dilapidated facade. Yet for 4 days last week, this pier turned into Collective One, a fair dedicated to contemporary and vintage design. Stephen Lerner founded the event, and he explains why New York needed yet another fair.
I'm an architect, an interior designer, and a collector, and so I've visited the art and design fairs throughout the world and always been impressed, amazed, overwhelmed by the quality of the material that I've seen in these fairs. And I just thought to myself, why does New York not have something of this quality? It was just a very simple question of need. And I thought I couldn't be alone in this question, so I went to a few friends in the industry, so gallerists, collectors, curators, museum friends, and said, what do you think? And they all said, absolutely, you do it, and we'll help you. The collective was part of the introduction and the brainstorming of how do we start this, what do we want, bringing together the perspectives of architects, designers, what do you want to see at a fair? As an exhibitor, what's important to you? What brings people together? How do you want the feel and the flow to go? So this was really brought from the ground up. I'm not a real estate developer. I'm not a fair manager. I'm not trying to fill a slot in my calendar. I'm trying to fill a need. And so I wanted to design a fair with as many voices as possible because I'd like to work collaboratively, and I thought that was the key to the success.
With 23 exhibitors and 3 special shows, Collective One presents the work of designers as varied as Sam Baron, Snarkitecture, and Greta Magnussen-Grossman. But its strength lies in the collaboration between galleries and organizers. Evan Snyderman, co-owner of the R20th Century Gallery in New York, is making final touches in his large booth at the center of the space.
We know Stephen personally. We've worked with him for many years. We understand his aesthetic, and he understands ours. So when he came to us with this idea of putting together a fair, at first we thought, well, of course, what everyone says, who needs another fair? We do a lot of fairs, and fairs are expensive and exhausting. But because the fact that we'd all been talking about something in New York like this for many years, and the idea that he came to us with this concept of working together with us, and hence the term collective, to feed off our ideas and our thoughts and our desires and our woes, to put together a fair through discussions and learning what does and doesn't work for all of us was really appealing. We rarely get a say in what happens, and in this case, we really did. And that is unique to this fair. We are showing quite a lot. We're focusing first off on the work of a pair of designers, Carlo Hauner and Martin Eastler, who lived and worked in Brazil and started a company called Forma in the 1940s in Sao Paulo. So all the work you see on the raised platform are by our Forma pieces. We've never exhibited their work before, so this is a collection we've been building for some time. And they're really one of the unsung heroes of Brazilian modernism. And then we're also featuring the work of Greta Magnussen-Grossman. So this half of the booth is a mix of really what the gallery represents in terms of design, which is a classical, historical, and contemporary. And then we also decided here to have a section of the booth dedicated to objects. And we love objects. We're collectors as well as dealers, and we've always had an interest in the smaller objects, and it's also it's something that's approachable and accessible for most people. You may not have a place to fit a large sofa, but you can always fit one more thing on the shelf somewhere.
This year, most of the artists exhibited are from the United States, with more than half of the galleries based in New York City. For Sarah Medford, the Director of Strategic Development at Collective Design Fair, it's a testament to the state of American design.
I think there's a New York spirit to this fair that we haven't seen before. I think it's very fresh, it's very upbeat, it's very downtown in a sense, a little more casual than the normal fair, and I think it's very American. Yes, we have European dealers. We're thrilled. We're looking forward to having more dealers from outside the U.S. in the future. But I think that to start with this core of New York dealers and a real American spirit is defining for us.
The idea to have the fair downtown was very important to founder Stephen Lerner, who says this is where New York's creative energy exists. And though it's not the first fair taking place on a pier, his experience as an architect and interior designer helped make the space uncluttered and easy to navigate.
Well, I took on several roles here. Obviously, in addition to founding the fair, I also designed it. And I've visited all these fairs, so I know what feels right and what doesn't to me. You know, I don't like the traditional fair of booth, 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 booth along an aisle, and you look left and you look right, and if something doesn't draw your eye, you don't go in. So here we have many vantage points where you look, you see an open plan, you walk from here to there to there. You know, you go where your eye will lead you. And it's very much for me always about the experience of the body moving through space. It really is about each person sort of finding their own individual path through. I think that to put this in context, it's always important to me as an architect that someone understands the context of where they are. We also use the windows because I think they're a guide for people to move through the space. I think people intrinsically move toward the light. So the way that the plan is laid out is a very open plan, and it's intended to let you pick a different path than I might pick.
And he hopes that the space will fill up with a diverse group of people.
We will have visitors, 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 which I'm excited about. The New York and international design and architecture community will come and support the fair. I think the next layer is the art collectors, whether it be Frieze, whether it be people here for the auctions, whether it be New York collectors. That's the next level of people that will definitely be in attendance. And I really want people to come off the Greenway. I mean, we are right on the water. We are right on this amazing bike path, running path, walking path that stretches from Battery Park City all the way up almost to the George Washington Bridge. It is a beautiful weather out right now. It's a beautiful time. I think people will walk along the High Line, they'll walk along the Greenway, and they'll see it, and they'll come in. And I think there's something for everybody. I mean, for me, this has always been about inclusivity, not exclusivity. There are works here that are inexpensive that someone can come in and buy. You don't have to be a patron, you don't have to be a collector to enjoy this fair.
With his eye already on Collective 2, 3, and 4, Stephen says he feels like an ambassador. Of course, he's hoping that exhibitors sell well, and that collectors find what they're looking for. But he also says he wants people to see things they've never seen before, proving that this is much more than just another fair. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. It's become increasingly popular for policymakers to use the language of design when talking about innovation in the public sector. But how can design actually inform the policy-making process? And are there any concrete examples of designers impacting public policy? Finland's Helsinki Design Lab was founded with the express purpose of developing more holistic, design-led solutions to problems faced by its government. It claims to have harnessed the skill set and mindset of designers to help solve challenges such as redesigning welfare services and city planning. Monocle's Annabelle Bly spoke with Marco Steinberg, Director of Strategic Design at the Finnish Innovation Fund, to find out more.
I started off with a deep love for buildings, for communities, for cities, but I began to realize that innovation at the building level was harder and harder to attain, that there were so many things that were already out of the equation at the brief that was being given architects that is really difficult to innovate. So I thought there was a real need to go upstream and help clients actually define the brief, define what the question is. You know, when you look at our urban environments, a lot of that gets built is not that great. Is it because we're lacking great designers, or do we need more enlightened clients? And I realized we need to work on the enlightened client side. And I've just taken this work now to go to broader kinds of questions. I spent 20 years in the States, and I was teaching at Harvard, and I ran a healthcare project there. This is how I began to get interested in design in this other capacity. And really, we took one disease, which was stroke, a condition that affects the brain, basically, and blood flow to it, and said, how would you rethink how we deliver care for stroke from cradle to grave? Like all the things that need to happen, prevention and acute and rehabilitation. And we began to realize that the principles that are built, we build with today, are completely flawed. We're trying to make the wrong idea more efficient as opposed to rethink it. So this idea of bringing design to actually bring synthesis, to find the right simplifiers, was a kind of inroad to innovation. You can actually innovate taking this perspective. Now there's a lot of naysayers. I mean, there's people who built careers arguing that the way we deliver stroke care today is the right way. So how do you get them on board? Is actually to show the weakness of the argument, and actually by delivering where people tell you it's impossible to deliver. So we went into regions in the US where the current thinking was, those are too rural, they're outside the system, and we're never gonna be able to solve it. And we went there with a model to actually help solve where the current thinking said you could not solve it. And that then will start getting attention. If you can save lives where people say it's impossible, then people are interested in understanding what did you do. So to make a long story short, I actually never talk about design because it confuses the conversation. I talk about what's the nature of the innovation mission that we have. And then you can back into design. What are some of the attributes you need? You need to be able to work across different bodies of knowledge. You need to bring the human factor in. You need to bring new tools like visualization tools to deal with the increasing complexity of the issues, right? And so on and so on. And then you can say you need to work iteratively. You need to deal with uncertainty. Who's most likely to have those kinds of attributes? I'm not arguing designers have it, but they're probably more likely to have a training that prepares them for it. And then you couple this with the fact you're saving lives, where others say it's impossible, then you can have a formed and an interesting conversation about design.
So Marco, perhaps you could give me some concrete examples of the projects that you're working on at the moment.
There is a deep ethnography bit to this, understanding culture, understanding how the kind of technical stuff and the cultural stuff and the economic stuff, how the different buckets of interest actually come together to find the right simplifier. And for me, the right simplifier is if you're doing it faster, cheaper, and better, you found a better simplifier. The other example I just bring very briefly is in social services. So there we have Jana, another fantastic woman we hired there, to help deal with services for families with children. And the ones that are most at risk are the ones that are having the hardest time getting the services they need. So this is a scenario that is quite common. I'm a young father, I have a 2-year-old daughter, it's 2 a.m, my kid's screaming, I need help. So I go online, Helsinki Social Services, I type it in, and guess what I get? I get a web page that tells me how the organization's organized. Do I care what departments they have? No, I don't. I need help. So we said we need to change this logic. We need to actually make it more like Google. Google is the easiest path to what you need to know. Could we do that? And what's interesting when you take a website approach is people say, oh, okay, it's just a website. So we changed it. And we launched a new service in 2 weeks that was really, what do you need and what's the quickest way to it? Who can help you? Their phone number, their picture, et cetera, et cetera. And procurement decision in 4 days for a new service and launched a new live service for the public in 2 weeks. I would challenge any business to come up with a new product decision in 4 days and a new product on the market in 2 weeks. It just doesn't happen. So I think the public sector, if it has the right smarts, can act really, really quickly. And when you change the website, so to speak, you're changing the front to the public and the promise, which puts pressure on the organization then to align itself with that new promise. And I think that's a far better way to do organizational change than change the organization and hope that it'll deliver something good. Do a concrete project that delivers better and put pressure on the organization to align itself with those new principles.
Marco Steinberg, director of Citra, there talking to Monocle's Annabelle Bly. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. This show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. Do please get in touch with Alid if you have a burning desire to feature on Section D. He can be reached day and night on awj@monocle.com. On next week's show, we'll be bringing you highlights from the What Design Can Do conference in Amsterdam. And we'll be dipping a toe into ICFF over in New York too. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in honour of Mr. Steinberg and the Finnish Innovation Fund, here's Finnish singer Jenni Vartiainen with En halu kuulla tänä yönä, which means I don't want to die tonight. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.